are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, August 17th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Hillary Clinton names her transition team, and Donald Trump's team transitions. Trump is also set to get intel briefings today. Oh, I should say, it's campaign manager, executive editor, publisher, Breitbart News. News in quotes. Barack Obama, President Obama, hits the campaign trail to promote the TPP. Floods in Louisiana take more lives. Massive fires in L.A. Polls in Texas show that the Republicans have dramatically lost the youth vote there. More on Aetna's decision to exit the Affordable Care Act exchanges. Guantanamo Bay will get even less crowded in the coming days. But will it close before Obama leaves office? And research on questionnaires shows that ISIS, not so steeped in Islam after all. And the heartwarming story of Trump's $25 million gift from Chris Christie. Finally, your tax dollars at work. Saudi Arabian Yemen strike kills more innocent civilians. All that on today's program, ladies and gentlemen.
I don't think this is right.
You haven't fixed. You got to fix. You guys got to do that when you. The beginning
I
of.
I didn't remember that. I'd be.
Wow. The inability to work this out is pretty impressive. There's the yawn.
Yep.
There's
the yawn because it's
I'm
boring.
So sick of hearing about how I can't figure out how to put two wires together.
I am.
Well, then you got to learn it. All right, folks.
Is that not
let's
learned?
Jump.
Is that not correct?
No, it is not.
Oh, really?
What
happened?
Oh, my God. All right. Here's a nice story, and we should say no guest today. So if we have any callers who want to call in, I'm particularly interested in talking to a libertarian. I know we got some suggestions as to libertarians who we could invite on the program for a debate from some university or something like that, and we'll get to that when we get back on the other side of our vacation. Certainly, if you're out there, give a call at 646-257-3920. I neglected to call into our system. 646-257-3920. The reason, of course, I bring this up is because there's a heartwarming story about Omaha, Nebraska today that... Atrios over at the blog Eschaton, I saw there, drew my attention, was quite interested in it. And for miles and miles in Omaha, there's an Omaha is sort of a spread out city with a lot of sort of suburban style houses. Apparently, the houses there are a little more expensive than I thought. Local officials began dispatching crews to tear up the asphalt in neighborhoods and turn the streets back into dirt roads because some of these roads were having potholes that were just simply too massive to maintain. No letter, no notice. We just came home on a Tuesday and our street was ground up, said Joe Sorodowski, a dentist who lives on 113th Street, where a dozen $400,000 and up houses now line a dirt path. Since there, it's been nothing short of a nightmare. Now, clearly, it seems to me that you got to give notice, or you should. But you go on to read about how Omaha apparently can't handle these roads. Omaha has about 440,000 people. There's 4,800 miles of roads. But unfortunately, there's not enough tax revenue to maintain them. And part of the problem is this. Decades ago, a number of developers sought permission to lay down asphalt roads rather than longer-lasting concrete. Now, if you know anything about asphalt and concrete, asphalt generally runs about 30% cheaper than concrete and has a lifespan of about, 20 years. And then you got to keep it upkeep, too. Cement, that could be forever. You'll get some cracks and whatnot. So there were several sections in the middle of the town where these developers wanted the right to just put down asphalt. And they didn't want to install curbs and gutters. The city agreed with the understanding that homeowners be responsible for the occasional repaving.
Hey, what happened?
Well, I'll tell you. Those substandard roads, those people who agreed to do it, the developers went away. The initial homeowners went away. And as the roads began to age and crumble, resentment intensified about a city government that maintained some neighborhoods while ignoring others. It's a matter of fairness, said Omaha Street Superintendent Austin Rouser. Some property owners paid for better streets, and a minority didn't. In other words, some people came in to their developments, got a discounted rate because their developer said, oh, we'll take care of the roads. The owners will have a homeowners association. And then, of course, you get this guy, Terry Hexum. Well, gee whiz, if I'm going to be on a gravel street, I don't think they should increase my taxes. Not realizing that they had already started lower than they should have been. And that's why you don't have quality roads. Signs went up denouncing Mayor Gene Stothert and Eddie's other city officials. One businessman filed a lawsuit that sought to force the city to repave the road in front of his $1.8 million home. Dan Potowski, an assistant professor of regional planning at the University of Nebraska, said the dispute is also forcing residents to think about what they get from government. This is especially useful, he said, in a conservative state like Nebraska that's skeptical of government spending. Smaller government is better, but we still want our roads to function, he said. Indeed. But it's always where you draw the line, isn't it? It's an outrage that my $1.6 million home, which has increased in value and was probably significantly cheaper for me, ultimately because we didn't pay the developer to do the proper road work in the first place, city cut a deal with them. Well, as a libertarian would tell us, you could just not go to that business anymore. I'm not buying my second or third home from that developer again without a clear indication as to whether or not I'm going to have a road. Just a sweet little story about that libertarian ideology. Let's go to the phones for one second. Let's see what we got here. You're calling from a 372 area code. Who's this?
Hello, this is Quark from Deep Space Nine. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Hey, just really quick, I'd like to apologize for the call that you got from the Negus. Look, he's a good businessman, but his comedic timing skills are very lacking. So let me just get right to my question. You know, one of the things that all beings of the universe have is the need to improve ourselves. Our ambition to improve ourselves, it motivates everything we do. Without ambition, without it, I dare I say it, greed. People would lie around all day doing nothing. They wouldn't work, they wouldn't bathe, they wouldn't even eat. They'd starve to death. Is that what you want?
I'm sorry? That was a serious question. No, I don't want people to starve to death. But if you think that people will starve themselves to death because they don't have greed, then I don't think you know about the fundamental aspects of biology. But I appreciate the phone call. Just note, John McLaughlin, who hosted the McLaughlin Group, well, it was a fun show to watch when I was a kid. I didn't particularly agree with a lot of the things that I heard there. He passed away, 89 years old. Apparently had prostate cancer. We would be completely remiss if we didn't say goodbye to him by saying this.
Bye-bye.
Right, there you go. John McLaughlin.
I never watched that show, but I remember Dana Carvey. Like, and it was weird because I watched this. I mean, I guess the show was still on all along, but it felt like something out of another, because I was watching the Dana Carvey sketch years after the Carvey sketch aired. But he did this bit where first he would go in a circle and he would ask them increasingly more just, you know, like, right, I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 20. Which one is it?
Right.
And then they'd be like, 15, and he'd go, wrong!
Well, that's
next
basically
question.
What it was. That's basically what the show was.
And then occasionally he would sort of like one of them, and he would say, you know perfectly well, Mort Kondracki, you're just being shy. Next question. And it was great.
I want to get to Clinton's transition team in a bit. I don't know how much we can read from that. Cuts a couple of different ways. But I want to talk about what's going on with Aetna, because this could have some serious impact on a lot of exchanges across the country in terms of reducing competition and, in some instances, no presence at all in some counties. Now, you've heard President Obama now has come out for, as well as Hillary Clinton, calling for the public option.
Surprise!
But that obviously is not going to happen with the makeup of the House and the Senate as it stands now. Who knows? That could change. But there's new reports out as to what could be motivating this. As of April of this year, Aetna was saying, we anticipate some loss in the beginning. Now, of course, here's the issue. The exchanges are for individual health insurance. And it is generally people who are not getting it through their employer. No, always, I should say. Not getting it through their employer or any other source. There has been more people and more sicker people who have been buying their insurance through these exchanges than was anticipated. And part of that reason is because of the subsidies. And you still can purchase individual insurance outside of the exchanges, which you do if you don't get subsidies. And so we have split off these exchanges are one risk pool, and the direct purchase is another risk pool. The problem is that the risk pool on the exchanges turns out to be too risky for these insurance companies, which, you know, for a long time, I mean, years ago, we spoke to Wendell Potter, who made it clear that the health insurance industry is a failed business model and could not do what it was set up to do, which is to provide health insurance for all Americans under the age of 65 who wouldn't get it through Medicare. That is because simply we have an aged population. We have 20% of the, I should say 80% of healthcare costs are borne by 20% of the people. The whole trick to the insurance industry is to not have those 20% people covered. And the exchanges have brought a lot of those people in. Some get covered by Medicaid. The exchanges have made it possible, still very expensive, but for a lot of those people to get coverage. And it turns out that these companies are losing money off of that. Now, part of it is one-time setup costs that could theoretically shrink over time. It is for someone who has not gotten regular health care. When they finally get health care, the costs are going to be front loaded. In other words, if I do no maintenance on my car for, I don't know, 25,000 miles, by the time I get to the mechanic, I'm going to have a lot of problems that have to be dealt with. But then after that, if I continue regular maintenance, I don't know, every 6,000 miles, every 7,500 miles, I'm going to be better off. To a certain extent, that's part of what is making it difficult for these insurance companies to make money. The other thing is that they look at the exchanges and they say, why are we participating in the exchanges where when that is a risk pool that costs us more money versus the sales that we get to individuals outside of the exchange? In Vermont and Washington, D.C., insurance companies can't make that choice. They can only sell individual policies through the exchange. And so they don't have that problem in those two areas, state and, I guess, city, because the risk pools become combined. And so the insurance company doesn't have this option between like a really profitable risk pool and a less profitable money-losing risk pool. But there is a reporting that suggests that that wasn't Aetna's only reason for leaving 11 of the 15 states' healthcare exchanges. And that, incidentally, will affect about 80% of their customers who are covered through the exchanges in total. Jonathan Cohn at Huffington Post has uncovered a letter, which apparently he had FOIA'd some time ago, that the about face that Aetna has announced in terms of now all of a sudden those losses that we had already projected and thought we could handle short term are just going to be too big and we have to get out, may be a function of something else. A letter that the CEO of Aetna had written to the U.S. government, I guess presumably the Department of Justice. This is from the Aetna CEO. In petitioning for the DOJ, or I should say in trying to convince the DOJ not to step in and attempt to stop a merger between Aetna and Humana, goes like this. It's very likely that we would need to leave the public exchange business entirely and plan for additional business efficiencies should our deal ultimately be blocked. The Aetna CEO, Mark Bertoloni, to the Department of Justice. If President Obama's administration refused to allow the merger to proceed, he wrote, Aetna would be in worse financial position and would have to withdraw from most of its markets. Quite likely, all of them. So there you have it. I mean, it is not necessarily a business imperative, but a making good on a threat. As recently as April, like I said, Bertoloni Bertolini told investors that Aetna could sustain losses on the exchanges for the time being because participation still represented a relatively cheap way to acquire new customers, particularly since the program was bound to have kinks in the early years. In other words, yeah, we'll take some losses for that first time that you come to a mechanic after 12,000 miles of no care in your car. But now that we know you're there and the government has subsidized you showing up at the mechanic and we'll have you for years to come, it's worth our while. Apparently, in the following 4 months, that calculation was completely reversed. So this is a problem that, frankly, I don't know what the solution is.
Single payer.
Well, no. I mean, ultimately, of course. But I don't know what the solution is, because the solution, to the extent that there can be one, is going to have to be done on an agency level. Now, I don't know how it is that the exchanges in Vermont and in D.C. don't allow for insurance companies to sell individual policies outside of the exchange. But I imagine that is the purview of state regulatory agencies that deal with insurance. So maybe that'll start happening in some states, and you'll see people, you'll see Aetna come back into the exchanges. I don't know. A public option would be, I mean, the idea of a public option would be essentially a, you want to call it a Medicaid buy-in, a Medicare buy-in. In these exchanges, basically an insurance agency selling policies on the exchange that did not have to make a profit. And that would, of course, drive competition, because these insurance agencies still theoretically want to be in business. And if they're not getting clients and they're not getting customers and they're losing out to public insurance, then they're going to have to do something about that, obviously. Let's go to the phones. You're calling from a 734 area code. Who's this?
Hi, this is Jack from Detroit.
Hello, Jack. What's on your mind?
So the public option, I was wondering about, what do you think? Do you think the universal or the public option is the better choice?
Well, those are not necessarily mutually exclusive things. Universal simply means a mechanism to make sure that everyone is covered. A public option is would be basically an attempt to ensure that there is a public option. I mean, theoretically, you could have universal coverage,
right,
all provided by private. So I'm not really sure what you're asking.
Right.
I mean, I think personally, I think there should be Medicare for all, a single payer. We just expand it from the amount of people that we have, and then have, like, you know, options for supplemental private insurance if you want. I think a public option, the support for the public option, I understand, like, I mean, here we are, we're talking about, I don't know, maybe 6-7 million people who are getting their insurance on the exchanges. It could be close to 9 at this point. And when you talk about the public option, you would be talking about offering that would have been, you know, maybe provided it for 2 million people, right, across the country, maybe 3. The whole theory with the public option was not that it in and of itself was going to solve massive problems, but that it was going to be a proof of concept that people want this, it's effective, and more people would go to the public option, would opt for the public option in the exchanges, and that would be indicative of a model for what we could adopt more broadly. And so, so I'm still in favor of the public option, because ultimately it should theoretically lead to an expansion of maybe first Medicare buy-in, and
right.
maybe Medicare becomes, you know, free by age 65, but you can buy in at starting, let's say, age 35.
Yep.
I mean, you know, there's a whole different, there's a myriad of different ways in which you can sort of, you know, do this. And I think if you start with a buy-in, you know, that starts maybe at age 55 and then drops to 45, so that you don't, mm-hmm. you know, you give sort of a soft landing for those private insurance companies and that private insurance industry. So, I mean, that's my take on that.
Yeah, because I think, because I was wondering, because since there's a, given that there's a $19 trillion debt, I was wondering if, you know, is there enough room for error for universal health care versus, you know, something that would, where you might have more room for error, like a public option?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I follow what you're saying, but a public option is obviously a much smaller project. And, you know,
right.
as a first step, it makes more sense to start there than it would with, I mean, it makes more sense, you know, just, I guess, tactically and strategically to start there than trying to do a, you know, a full-on buy-in for Medicare, I guess. And I think that was the theory behind the
right.
development of healthcare reform before it ended up getting voted on. I appreciate the call. Let's go to this moment on Fox News, where Juan Williams upsets. It's almost like these guys on The Five, they needed a safe space for like four of them. But as in the wake of Aetna announcing that it's going to be dropping out of these exchanges, here are four not terribly sophisticated thinkers talking about health insurance, about which I'm sure that they have barely ever even cracked like page two of an article on that, because Breitbart is right, it's all one page stuff.
Yes, and I think you're being generous.
That's possible, but let's hear them.
Help them on that messaging.
Well, I mean, the messaging is, you know, indisputable. I mean, right now, according to the numbers, 90% of Americans are insured for the first time in history. So, you know, and most of the people who remain uninsured are eligible for Obamacare.
Yeah, it costs about $1 trillion to insure a few million people.
Here is the real bad news for this table, I tell you that, which is that when Americans are asked, hey, what do you think about Obamacare? Would you repeal it? They don't say that. No, they said the government should pay for single-payer, government-supported health care. Oh, my God, I think this table's going to explode.
What poll is that one?
That's Gallup.
No, because it says it's unpopular by 51 to 45.
It's unpopular, but they want more.
They want more.
They want more.
Oh, if you could only read polls.
Always have an advantage.
Santa Claus.
Well, the problem with Santa Claus is no one ever wants their presents returned.
Yeah. You know?
Well, that means the argument is much harder for conservatives and whatnot, because people like government services. I mean, that's almost identical to the argument I had with who's that guy, the brother of that guy?
The Schiff guy.
Peter Schiff's brother called into the program years ago. And at one point was just like, well, that's the problem with the American people. They like government services.
Granted, Americans like clean water and health care, but setting that aside.
Yeah, I mean, just imagine the audacity of a people setting up a government to provide for them things that they want. How outrageous could that be? That's the problem with Santa Claus. But here's the difference. Government's real, not fictional. And we're not talking about a shiny new bicycle. We're talking about health care. But you know what? If the American people decided that they think their government should provide for them shiny new bicycles, I don't know that I see a problem with that either. If they're willing to actually fund it.
Libtard.
I mean, we see bike shares now. Granted, in this city, it's you know, a public-private partnership. But it's on public space.
You're goddamn right.
That's right. That is ultimately the last refuge from conservatives. Like, Americans are just spoiled by they wanting to have things from government. It was pretty funny.
And that's not even presents they already have yet.
That's right. You want Santa Claus to come and provide insurance, to provide treatment for your cancer.
Santa Claus wants to give your kid an inhaler, okay? I get it.
Yeah.
Not really that spectacular.
Well, maybe Santa Claus shouldn't come down a chimney that probably has coal particles that probably enhance that kid's asthma.
I don't know about that part. Coal particles are a myth.
Oh, you don't think you get that?
I'm so tired of everybody blaming the Koch brothers for the coal particle myth. Maybe if we just had good old-fashioned values, people could breathe some coal particles and get back to work. Expecting government to give them everything. Or Santa Claus.
Well, you should bring us some clean coal technology.
Bill O'Reilly is having a difficulty also watching both the implosion of his own network, his partner in crime, and I say that metaphorically. I don't actually think that Bill O'Reilly and Roger Ailes simultaneously harassed the same people. I think it was happening probably in parallel. I'm not even sure
that's my harem, Bill. Back off.
I mean, one has to wonder, did Bill O'Reilly come in and compare notes? Like, when I'm harassing my producers, what's the best way to do this? How can I be sure, let's say, for instance, I'm not recorded? There's not an audio recording of me.
Say, baby, put down that pipe and get my pipe up.
Bill O'Reilly having a similar freak out as Sean Hannity, as there's a feeling probably over there that the walls are tumbling down. What is the last refuge for a scoundrel like Bill O'Reilly? Oh, I know. That is to compare everybody to David Duke. Here's Bill O'Reilly opening a show last night with a monologue comparing George Soros to David Duke.
Soros, everyone should be able to go wherever they want for any reason and stay there. Recently, hackers believed to be backed by Russia exposed more than 2,000 documents connected to Soros and his open society. The information, very disturbing. Soros has given about $10 million to groups opposed to the policies of Israel. He has funded individuals accusing Israel of war crimes. He has given a variety of grants to people who literally hate the Jewish state of Israel. In addition, Soros has funded investigations of individuals here in the USA who are opposed to radical Islam.
Pause for a second. First off, I have no doubt that Soros's positions on Israel are shared by close to 70% of the Jews in this country. That may be a little bit low. B, the idea that this guy who has a foundation called Open Society would want some type of like world where societies are open is that really that shocking?
Well, his support of Islamic Jihad is surprising in that context.
Soros gave money to places like Think Progress, the Center of American Progress, to basically report on the backgrounds of people like Pamela Geller. And who's that other lunatic? Frank Gaffney,
yep. And Spence, I think.
When you get all that stuff from Think Progress or from other websites, let's say, that say, like, Pam Geller, she did this in that year, and Frank Gaffney accused Grover Norquist of being a secret Muslim Brotherhood plant. And Huma Abedin is meeting with the 9/11 terrorists in the basement in a parking lot somewhere. Well, someone's got to write that, and that person's going to be paid. But let's continue.
Pamela Geller, Frank Gaffney, Liz Cheney, and Cliff May. Mr. May will be here in just a few moments. Finally, George Soros has donated about $13 million to the Democrats this election cycle. That includes $7 million to a Hillary Clinton super PAC.
Pause it. Now, for years, we have been told, and the right wing has been told, that George Soros funds everything, to the point where we've had callers call into this program legitimately believing that George Soros was personally keeping me from saying certain things. So the idea that George Soros has donated $13 million to the Democrats this election cycle, including $7 million to a Clinton super PAC, is that a surprise to anybody? My only shock is, like, why is this guy being so stingy? The Koch brothers are still, I mean, had planned to dump in $1 billion. And that only got usurped by the fact they didn't want to pay for Donald Trump. God knows how much they're dumping into down ticket races. I mean, I hope that's going to be the next thing we hear from Bill O'Reilly. Like, can you believe this cheapskate? Good.
12 years ago, here's what Mrs. Clinton said about George Soros.
We have been given an extraordinary blessing. And at this moment in time, our country needs us.
Now, to be fair, that soundbite is dated, but the Clinton campaign
I'm sorry,
is
pause accept- it. Wait a second.
I don't understand.
Did you just cut something out of that?
What just happened?
Yes, Hillary Clinton said, we've been given a blessing. She said, and now to be fair, she said that 12 years ago. All right, go ahead.
Money from Soros this year is stated, and that may present a problem for the secretary. You may remember that Donald Trump got hammered by the media for not disavowing David Duke quickly enough. Duke, of course, a far right hater. But now we have a far left individual, Soros, bent on harming Israel, America's strongest ally in the Middle East. So how will the media cover that? Again, Soros, one of the biggest donors to the Democratic Party.
What? David Duke. So I guess the idea is he's going back. Who wrote that talking points memo? Because, you know, that thing was only, what, 2 minutes long? And it was completely incomprehensible. Maybe he should drop it down to like 15 seconds so that they can just get one point across. George Soros bad. Will media talk about that?
Also like David Duke. So Trump not so bad.
Right.
See?
Well, I guess we can forgive Bill O'Reilly for one instance on his program comparing someone, something to David Duke that is completely out of left field, okay? So he says that George Soros is like David Duke because George Soros gives to the Democrats and the Republicans had to distance themselves from David Duke. Does that make sense? No. But, you know, Bill O'Reilly, like I say, he's going through a lot of tough times now at Fox News. At least he only did that one time in his program that night. What?
I don't think we should shut down Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter is misguided in the extreme. And here's my point about Graceland, getting back to Elvis. This makes the group hateful to people who like Elvis Presley. You know, Elvis Presley is an icon in this country. Whether you know, I feel sorry for the man more than anything else, but he was a tremendous entertainer. Now that you drag him and his family into this protest, and most Americans, white Americans, are going, what are you doing? What are you doing? That would be like David Duke going in front of Otis Redding's house to try to make some crazy point that he wants to make. It's the same inappropriate venue.
No, it's not. Look, I think...
Yeah.
Wow.
He actually can't. I got nothing.
David Duke was the head of an organization whose primary function was to get rid of anyone who was not white in the country. And an organization whose legacy was of lynchings and killings and burnings and attackings of black families. So how would that be like if he showed up at Otis Redding's house? If he showed up at Otis Redding's house, what he would do in his capacity as the Grand Wizard of the KKK would be to burn a cross, throw bricks into Otis Redding's house, try and go in there and perhaps lynch Otis Redding. I don't think that's what Black Lives Matter was doing. I think they were protesting at a place where they knew there would be a large concentration of media.
Jack in the Bay. Makes total sense. Otis Redding sitting there, David Duke shows up. Same thing as Graceland.
Same thing. Well, that was two David Duke comparisons in one night.
It's like David Duke. It's like David Duke.
I wonder if Bill O'Reilly had just come from dinner with David Duke.
So funny, Dave and I were just talking about this, how it's the same thing. Same thing. Bill O'Reilly has, I mean, always, he's horrible, but he's always been at least, like, I can always follow the logic of his distorted premises.
Right.
This is the first time where I'm just, I don't get it.
Let's take one more phone call, and then we'll go to the fun half. You're calling from a 917 area code. Who's this?
Oh, hey, this is Jake, the art teacher. Hold on, just. I have two devices because I'm holding.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you. So say your name again.
Hi, can you hear me now?
Yep.
Oh, this is Jake, the art teacher.
Hi, Jake. How are you?
Good, good. I was calling in because you mentioned Center for American Progress, and you also mentioned the news about Hillary's transition team.
Yep.
And. So I wanted to point out, you know, I'm a teacher, and, you know, the teachers were kind of up in arms. They booed Hillary when she made a mention in a speech about charter schools. And I wanted to point out that one of the people named to her transition team is a woman named Ann O'Leary from Center for American Progress. This is a lady that... you know, the revolving door thing. She supports Common Core, the very controversial standards, and is actually defending them even to this day, you know, which is a signal when Hillary appoints her as part of the transition team that we're going to be going full bore for charter schools and then testing.
Well,
and,
no, wait a second.
And Common Core.
Jake, all right. Yeah. Well, I mean, let me just... Maybe you're not articulating the phone, but the problem, first off, is there really something problematic with Common Core in and of itself? Or is what's problematic with Common Core is that it's used as a metric in which to judge the efficacy, the competency of teachers, and as whether or not a school gets funded? I mean, isn't that the problem? Not so much the standards in and of themselves?
The standards in and of themselves are perfectly fine for a suburban Massachusetts school. The problem is that, you know, the every kid in every state is not, you know, economically privileged as them, and therefore they come to school less prepared, they come to school... functioning, you know, at a grade level far lower. So if the standards were voluntary, there would probably be no controversy.
Right, okay.
But they were pushed on, yeah.
But now, you know, isn't that, aren't they in retreat on this now, though? I mean, doesn't it seem, I mean, from my perspective, it seems like they're in retreat on it, A. But that also doesn't, okay, so, and then let me go a little further. There isn't necessarily a relationship between that and charters. I'm not defending. I don't know anything about this one. I'm just taking your statement at face value. I can tell you this. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to run the interview I did with, I think his name is Dan Montgomery. He is the vice chair or vice president of the American, of the AFT, the American Federation of Teachers. And and I'll tell you, I was very encouraged after talking to him. He was a lot more frank than you know, anytime I've talked to Randy Weingarten. He was willing to say some things that I was sort of a little bit surprised that he said, like things like, yeah, we got right out in front and endorsed Hillary Clinton. This is from the convention. But, you know, that was because we didn't realize that Bernie Sanders would be doing so well early on. And but nevertheless,
that's nice to admit.
And he also was very specific. He said without reservation that he thinks that Hillary Clinton is going to be significantly better on education than Obama was. And this is a guy who came from Illinois who had some real problems with Arne Duncan. So I think there are, I'm going to talk about the transition team in a minute. I don't. I don't think that one can garner that from the transition team. I think there are some other issues with the transition team that are indicative, but I wouldn't be so. I'm not convinced. Let's put it that way. That's going to be a problem.
It's not too much, you know, because education was taken out of this election, out of the primaries and out of the debates, because both unions endorsed Hillary so early. We really haven't had a chance to go over this, but
I agree.
The bar for Hillary to be better than Obama on education is very low.
Yes.
Obama is considered, you know, worse than Bush, believe it or not. That's backed up by, you know, Race to the Top, which is, you know, a version of No Child Left Behind on steroids. So, you're right that they did back off of Common Core on the federal level, but it depends how you look at it. You could also say that taking away the federal mandates just turns it over to the states, and now you have 50 times the headache because Common Core is now going to be battled individually in every state. And Anne O'Leary went to the Democratic Convention in Philly talking about how great the Common Core was, you know,
But my point is if it is up to the states at this point, Anne O'Leary is not that relevant in the conversation.
Hillary is signaling support for, you know, education reform includes Common Core.
Anne O'Leary has been working with her, if I'm not mistaken, I think was her chief of staff when she was I think even before then. I think what was it, O'Leary? Was she the one who was when she was first lady or when she was a senator? I mean, you know.
She worked in the Clinton administration first, and then when Hillary became the senator for New York, was her top aide. And ever since then, she's been her chief education advisor.
Okay. Well.
Yeah,
that is. That part I didn't realize.
So, you know, it's just something to look out for because education really does not get too much ink and talk. So, if you are in the biz, you know, it is
it's
concerning.
Worrisome.
I mean,
all right. Well, fair enough.
Yeah,
fair enough.
Yeah.
We'll talk more about that coming forward.
Maybe I'll say like a call in tomorrow. I mean, you don't take calls during an interview, but maybe discussing Dan Montgomery tomorrow. That sounds interesting.
Yeah, listen to it. I'm not going to be here, but it's a pre-tape. Michael will be here in the fun half. But listen to it. I'd love your feedback when I get back. Appreciate it.
Great.
Also, next week, Paul Tough. We recorded an interview with him, who. There's, you know, wrote some books over the past like 10 years that got mixed reviews from people in the fighting sort of the privatized education movement. And I think to a certain extent he's evolved. But I think ultimately my sense is that the work he did is quite helpful in beginning to undercut the idea of high stakes testing. And even the ability to sort of measure quantitatively how people are being taught. But that'll be next week. All right, we're going to take a break, head into the fun half. Folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. We are headed on vacation over the next couple of days. It's going to be sort of like a ramp up. Tomorrow on the program will be pre-tapes that I did from the DNC that you have not heard, including Dan Montgomery from the AFT, including Alex Perrine. Get him to talk about the Gawker thing, which I don't know if he's done in other places. And this is before it was bought up, but I think he had a sense that it was going to happen. Also, an interview I did with John Nichols. It was really interesting for why Bernie Sanders had stayed in as long as he had in the race. And then, of course, on Friday, Michael will be here with Cliff Schechter, to do our normal Cliff Schechter thing. And then we've done pre-tapes for all of next week. And Jimmy Dore is going to be on the program.
Jimmy Dore, yeah.
Jimmy Dore is going to come on and ostensibly give a movie recommendation. I hope you take him to task.
About
the did you not see the video where he was, I don't think he was quite slamming me in it, but...
Wait, he slammed you?
Well, I mean, there
oh,
is...
Oh, I will praise him for it. I'll fast-track the interview.
There you go. Yeah. So that could be, that could either just be...
No, but seriously, what was the video?
Well, it was that night that I was on Hayes when the Clinton people had put out that John Negroponte supports us. And Jimmy was upset because Joan Walsh thought it was a bad idea for her for Clinton to do this. And he's like, this is what we were trying to tell you. About Hillary Clinton. And he was mad at Hayes because Hayes had, I don't know if he had said it to Susan Sarandon or what, but you remember when Susan Sarandon was on about the crazy. Yes. Now, from my perspective, Hayes was responding specifically to the idea that bringing in Trump would usher in a revolution, which I imagine... that Jimmy does not agree with anymore, or he'd be voting for Trump. As far as Joan Walsh, I think that, frankly, she was... what's the phrase I'm looking for? She had jumped the shark over some of her criticism.
Her writing on the campaign primary specifically was not good.
No, I didn't think so. I mean, I think...
And particularly, I would say from her, from my perspective, strikingly not good, because she's never been, to be blunt, like a go-to person for me. But I've read her stuff in the past, and she's not, like, she's a good commentator. So it was even more striking to me.
Yeah,
it felt
I felt like,
a like big
it was over
off.
The top. Was, I think there was a lot of over-the-topness in that. And but there was a sense that, I mean, I think Jimmy was careful not to ascribe these things to me because...
I was going
to
say, where do you come into it?
Well, I said that this was incredibly stupid for her to be touting the endorsement of Negroponte. And basically what I said on this program was that I thought it was some staffer who didn't realize that Negroponte was a net negative, you know, in any shape or form. Particularly for the campaign to tout, I think in every 15 minutes, every time that Hillary Clinton's name is brought up, you say, but on foreign policy, I mean, so I think we
as a
show have been pretty clear on it, and I raised, you know, in that context, like it's that Hillary had not particularly. Had not particularly, you know, made herself, had not particularly distinguished herself in her response to the 2009 Honduran coup. Oh, yeah. And so to raise Negroponte, probably not a good idea. But, I mean, Jimmy was mad because he was, I think, more mad at Chris Hayes and Walsh. But I don't think that either of them ever said that that her hawkery wasn't problematic in some way. I think the idea was that Donald Trump is worse, and that still remains to be the case. I mean, I didn't follow Joan Walsh a lot of the stuff, but I'm fairly confident in terms of Hayes. But
we will probably be focusing more on movies.
I hope. When he comes on, I hope when he comes on, it is the first thing, like literally the first thing you play for him. You should do that. I think people would enjoy it. I think it would be funny.
Okay, we'll see. How
Friday
long is,
how now,
long is the clip?
Friday
is now Controversy Friday.
Yeah, exactly. All right, we got to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. Again, you can become a member. Support this program. It's pennies a day. It is greatly appreciated, and it's what keeps us going. We occasionally have ads, but if you're a member, you won't have to hear those podcast ads. We always try and put the deals though that we're offering on the our support our sponsors page at majority.fm. I got to catch up with that. But you know, we roll out new technology. You know, like our app. It's a great way to listen to the show. It's broken right now in terms of archives. We're going to get that fixed in the next couple of weeks. But you know, these things don't grow on trees, ladies and gentlemen, and certainly not in Brooklyn. The trees here we have limited choice of trees. They don't.
And I believe when we designed it in terms of trees, we were still in Midtown. So imagine just the barren desert that is Midtown Manhattan.
We're trying to roll out a technology that's going to allow at least our regular guests to have a much higher quality of audio. I don't know if people noticed when Kelly, she didn't call into the show on Monday.
Some people did notice how.
Did
clear
people
her phone
did notice?
Was.
Yep. Okay, that technology. Striking. It's too expensive for us to, as it is now, to get every guest on that. But with a little bit of money, I'm hoping that we can reverse engineer something so that we can sort of build something that we can use in the future for this. And we won't be able to get it with all our guests, but a significant number of our guests, I think, will be able to do this, and it'll make a huge difference to the audio quality of the show. So stuff like that, and it just keeps us growing, you know. So if you can become a member, please join themajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy your crap from Amazon, the least you can do is to buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. You will notice no difference, but we will get a kickback every time you use that link. So you click on it, you bookmark it, that's your Amazon link. And you can do the same thing for jet.com. It's going to be bought by a Walmart. So I don't know if people are still interested in that. But if you are, majorityreportkickback.com, same deal. All right, quick break. 646-257-3920.